anywhere.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Claire Roth, sitting in for Ann today. Today marks the 75th anniversary of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima, Japan. The U.S. dropped a second bomb 3 days later on Nagasaki, forcing the Japanese to surrender. No country has used nuclear weapons in armed conflict since, but we're looking back on the attacks 75 years later. And in the program later, we'll hear the state of disarmament across the globe. Joining us for this conversation is Rose Gottemuller. She's a diplomat and Columbus native. She was the Deputy Secretary General of NATO and the U.S. Undersecretary of State Arms Control and International Security. Plus, from 2009 to 2010, she was the chief negotiator of the U.S.-Russian New START Nuclear Arms Reduction Treaty. Welcome to the program, Rose.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
And Alex Wellerstein joins us. He's a historian of nuclear weapons and director of the Science and Technology Studies Program at the Stevens Institute of Technology in New Jersey. He's the author of Restricted Data, the History of Nuclear Secrecy in the United States, and the creator of the Nuke Map Nuclear Weapons Simulator website. Welcome, Alex.
Really pleased to be here. Thank you.
So I think a lot of times when we hear about this bombing, it gets reduced to kind of a four-word phrase, the bombing of Hiroshima, Japan. But I'm curious if you can help us understand what it actually would have felt like and looked like in Hiroshima 75 years ago. Alex?
The accounts we have of survivors are extremely vivid. They all start with it being a sort of nice, straightforward morning, and maybe they see a single plane flying over the city, and then chaos. Bright light, buildings collapsing around you, and then a seemingly endless fire, and attempts to get out of the main area to tend to those who are injured, people who seem like they're doing well, but then who die of mysterious sickness several hours later, and then an inevitably long process to try and reconstruct what remained of their family, their lives, and so on. So one of the descriptions that the Japanese used at the time, who evaluated it, was that it was a sort of hell on earth, and that seems pretty apt.
I'm wondering if you can help us understand the death toll. You wrote an article for The Bulletin about how this number isn't finite. Help us understand, you know, the toll of destruction, how widespread deaths were, and in what time frame.
So in terms of time frame, pretty much everybody agrees that about 70% of the deaths happened almost immediately at the time of the bombing, and that the remaining amount, most of those happened within the next few weeks. So it isn't the case that it lasted years and years. There are some long-term lingering cancer deaths and things like that, but most of the deaths are relatively quickly. Figuring out the number of dead was a real difficulty and a real interest, because not only did the Japanese want to understand what happened, but the Americans want to understand how these atomic bombs work in war, because they are afraid that more wars might be happening with them in the future. The Army did a lot of work right after World War II ended to try and estimate the deaths at Hiroshima. They came up with around 65,000 dead at Hiroshima. Later reevaluations in the 1970s by international scientists and the Japanese concluded that it might be as many as 140,000, that a lot of people may have been missing from that count. The difficulty is that the record system was not great at its best, but many of the records were destroyed in the bombing itself. And locating the families and the people who were involved, it isn't a simple matter of counting corpses. They cremated the corpses very quickly, and many of the corpses were probably just destroyed by the bombing anyway. So there will sort of always be fundamental uncertainties. You have to use sort of statistical methods, and depending on what assumptions you make, you can get really different results.
Yeah. Of course, we know the immediate impact of the dropping of these bombs. It ended World War II with the Japanese surrender. But Rose Gottemuller, as someone who's been the Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security, I'm wondering how you reckon with the legacy of these bombings. How do you conceive of them when it comes to, you know, the arc of the United States military?
it's part of the continuing responsibility of the United States to address the legacy of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And that means continuing an arms control and reduction process. We signed up to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which was negotiated in the late 1960s and entered into force in 1972. We signed up to it, making the commitment that we would continue to reduce and eliminate nuclear weapons until we got to zero. And so we embrace that as our national responsibility. Others, thank the Lord, have joined us. Russia, China is part of the Non-Proliferation Treaty as well. In fact, most of the countries of the world are members of the NPT, but those who have nuclear weapons have committed to reduce and eliminate them. And I think that is our continuing responsibility. It's not a long, an easy process. It is a long process. And as we like to say, not in my lifetime will we totally eliminate them, but nevertheless, we have to keep working at it.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Claire Roth, sitting in for Ann today, and we're talking about nuclear weapons, the 75th anniversary of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima, Japan. With me is Alex Wellerstein, a nuclear weapons historian at the Stevens Institute of Technology, and Rose Guttemuller, a Columbus native who from 2016 to 2019 served as the Deputy Secretary General of NATO. And Rose, you were there at the 70th commemoration of the attack 5 years ago. You were in Japan. Tell us about that day.
Yes, I wanted to commend you on your coverage in the previous slot of the blast in Beirut. And the person who was interviewed there compared it to Hiroshima. I think that's an apt comparison in some ways. And I do want to express all my sympathy for what's going on in Beirut in these days after that horrible explosion, which also produced a mushroom cloud. So it doesn't have to be nuclear weapons that produce mushroom clouds. But one significant difference was that the glass you see on the street in Beirut would have been melted in Hiroshima, and people's skin was melted off their bodies. And that is the tale that you understand when you go to those two cities, because they are beautiful. They are on the ocean. They are like almost like resort cities in their beauty. But you go to the museums, you go to the memorials, you talk to the Hibakusha, the survivors, and you realize the profound damage that these weapons of mass destruction cause. And you can begin to sense a little bit about what this day must have been like 75 years ago in Hiroshima. So it was a huge honor for me to be there. I did my best to represent the United States on that occasion. I was the highest ranking official at that time to be there with our ambassador to Tokyo at the time, who was Carolyn Kennedy. And it was good to be there, the two of us, and to be representing the United States. President Obama went some months later. But, you know, honestly, they are such beautiful cities that it's hard to even think about how they could have been targeted in these attacks. They were not the huge industrial cities that one would think might have been the targets. Nevertheless, they were selected, and the result is as we still remember it 75 years later.
Yeah, listening to you describe some of the impacts of those bombings, the devastation that came down. Alex, I'm curious, how much did we know about the impact of these bombs before we deployed them? Of course, there was a test the month before, but I'm curious how much we knew, because of course, these were the first and so far the last nuclear weapons to be detonated in armed conflict.
There were a lot of unknowns. There was no doubt that they were going to be incredibly destructive and that they were going to destroy these cities. That was the point. They were meant to be, as they put it, the scientists put it, spectacular. They were meant to impress the Japanese and the entire world with the power of this new technology. But in terms of the actual details of how the human effect would be, it's clear that even they, who had studied this very closely and had tried to extrapolate up from other kinds of explosions and wars and things like this, they got it quite wrong. Robert Oppenheimer, the head scientist on the project, had estimated that a weapon of this sort dropped over a city would kill maybe 20,000 people. and at a minimum, it killed three times that, and perhaps even more than that. And he was later asked about this in the 1950s, and whether this gave him any sort of moral scruples, as the person asked them. He said it did very much, that he found it very disturbing that they had been so off in their understanding. Mm. That being said, 20,000 people is still a lot of people.
No kidding. And Americans arrived at the end of August to assess the effect that the bombs had had. They're part of the counts that you had mentioned earlier in terms of how many deaths there were. But what else did they kind of find out or discover about the impact of this bomb, you know, after the first time deploying it?
They were interested in every aspect of what had happened, from the most sort of mundane physical, why did certain buildings get knocked over and other buildings, the skeletons of them survived? Why did certain trees survive versus others? And down to the very social, what did this do to hospital services in a city like Hiroshima? How did it affect railway communication and food distribution? And this wasn't because they were so interested in Hiroshima for its own sake. It was because they were anticipating that this was going to be one of their only, we can put it in scare quotes, sort of test cases or guinea pigs for what happens when a nuclear weapon goes off over a city. And it's kind of disturbing to think about it in that way in retrospect. That isn't why they dropped the bomb to begin with, but they certainly took advantage of that fact because they wanted to make sure that if they were going to be planning for atomic attacks against other countries or for atomic attacks against the United States, they would know what to expect. And I think it's been very fortunate that Hiroshima and Nagasaki are the only cases we have to go on in this respect.
Yeah, absolutely. And Rose, I'm interested, it's been 75 years, but Hiroshima and Nagasaki still loom so large in the country's imagination. And I'm wondering if you believe that part of that study, knowing the effects of this and understanding the devastation that it rained down on these cities, has helped us avoid using these weapons again.
I think, frankly, to be very honest with you, it does not loom large in the public consciousness here in the United States. I'm very much welcoming this really solid coverage we're seeing across the country of the 75th anniversary, because I hope it will get people wakened up again to the horrific power of these weapons. And I think it's important that we do remember. In Japan, it's quite different. The Japanese remember deeply, and they will talk to you intensively about this. And this is one of the reasons why they are so profoundly committed to being a non-nuclear weapon state. So it is, I think, something that's deep in their national consciousness, but not in ours. So I think we do need to continue to pay attention, and we need to continue to try to bring these issues before the public. And by the way, just to add to the previous comment about the study of testing, you know, the study of the nuclear weapon, we did do a number of nuclear tests, over 1,000 nuclear tests, and many of them in the 1950s were conducted above ground in Nevada. And soldiers were brought there and, you know, put in trenches a short distance away to see how they would survive the blast. They put farm animals out there to see what would happen with a blast close by to them. So there was a lot of testing that went on. It was not use of these bombs in warfare, but it was testing to see what the effects would be and to see actually whether they could be usable on a battlefield. And after years of work and years of experience and a very serious crisis, the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962 that brought us to the brink of a nuclear exchange with the Soviet Union, it was at that point, I think, that our leaders began to say, these are not something that really have that much utility in wartime. They are not weapons that will help advance our objectives in war. Instead, their destructive power is such that they will stop us in our tracks and everybody else and lead to global destruction.
And we're going to talk a little bit more about the evolution of geopolitical relationships in terms of nuclear power coming up in just a moment on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We are talking about the 75th anniversary of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima today with Alex Wellerstein, a nuclear weapons historian at the Stevens Institute of Technology, and Rose Guttemuller, a Columbus native who is the Deputy Secretary General of NATO, also the chief negotiator of the U.S.-Russian New START nuclear arms reduction treaty. They're both staying with us. We'll hear more coming up in just a moment on All Sides. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Claire Roth, sitting in for Ann today. 75 years ago, the United States dropped an atomic bomb on Hiroshima, following it up 3 days later with another in Nagasaki. It's the only time nuclear weapons have been used in armed conflict, but of course, their very existence and the evolution of nuclear programs since has driven much of international relations in the last 75 years. This hour, we're talking about the impact they've had and how our understanding has evolved. If you'd like to join the conversation, if you have a question about nuclear weapons, give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Still with us is Alex Wellerstein, a nuclear weapons historian at the Stevens Institute of Technology and author of the forthcoming book, Restricted Data, The History of Nuclear Secrecy in the United States. Thanks for being with us, Alex.
Pleased to be here.
And Rose Guttemuller is a Columbus native who, from 2016 to 2019, was the first woman to serve as the Deputy Secretary General of NATO. And prior to that, she was the U.S. Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security. Rose, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
So you started to talk about this before the break, but no nuclear weapons have been used in armed conflict since that three-day period, 75 years ago. Why?
Well, I think because of their huge destructive power and the fact that, frankly, we have now built up nuclear weapons in a number of nuclear weapon states under the Non-Proliferation Treaty. It's the UK, France, China, Russia, and the United States who possess nuclear weapons. And outside the NPT system, there are, of course, India and China, and North Korea has acquired nuclear weapons. We're concerned that Iran may get them as well. But the main point is that we stand deterred from using nuclear weapons because of their horrific destructive power. Everybody understands that. And we and the Russians have kept our numbers at parity, equal. And so there is an equal balance of terror, as we like to say. Nevertheless, we are continuing to push in the direction of reducing and eliminating nuclear weapons. So we eliminate this weapon of mass destruction from the earth, but it's going to take a long time. So in the meantime, we depend on deterring each other.
Alex, how do you reckon with that question? Why do you think no weapons of this nature have been used in conflict since that day or those days?
Well, historians have sort of two answers to this. One is the sort of rational one that the previous commentator put out, which is we saw that they entailed a lot of difficulties and you get into things like deterrence eventually and things like that. There's also a thread that runs through it, especially in the very early days when there wasn't anything like parity, when the United States was the only nuclear power in the world. And even after the Soviet Union got the atomic bomb, the United States had many, many times more nuclear weapons than it for quite a long time. And that's a sort of taboo aspect, a sort of emotional revulsion. And in the United States, when you open up the archives, you can see that this plays a role for a number of the presidents in that time period. You might have people sometimes in the military who were very hot to use nuclear weapons for the first sort of 20 years of the nuclear age, but it was consistently presidents who were less likely to go down that path. And to me, the most interesting aspect is that the person who in some ways started that approach and was very pronounced in it was Harry Truman. But that only happened after the Nagasaki attack.
Well, and I'm curious about Truman's role and the president's role more generally when it comes to the deployment of these sorts of weapons, how much power does the president have?
Truman set it up, and you can say he set this up the day after Nagasaki, but it wasn't formalized until about 1948, so that the president of the United States is the only person who can order a nuclear attack. And at the same time, in principle, there's nobody else who has any legal authority to sort of stop that if the president does make that order. And he set that up not because he was interested in using the bombs. It's pretty clear from the Truman administration that after Nagasaki, he was somewhat horrified by nuclear weapons and spoke of them in these terms of that this is not a military weapon. One of the phrases he used in December of 1945 was that the atomic bomb was the most efficient means ever invented for the slaughtering of women and children. I mean, this is not a positive description. And he thought that if he centralized the power within himself and the presidency, that would keep the military from sort of starting nuclear wars. And so we have, that system has undergone a lot of evolution since the 1940s, to be sure. But that fundamental sort of legal idea that the president is the one who makes that decision, and essentially only the president is the one who makes that decision, that's still what's in place today.
We are talking about nuclear weapons on the 75th anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima, Japan. My guest, Alex Wellerstein, a nuclear weapons historian at the Stevens Institute of Technology, and Rose Guttemuller, Columbus native and first woman to serve as the Deputy Secretary General of NATO, plus the U.S. Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security. Looking back at Truman specifically, one of the physicists who worked on the Manhattan Project sent him a petition urging him to give the Japanese a chance to surrender before dropping the bomb. 70 scientists signed it. It read in part, quote, "Thus a nation which sets the precedent of using these newly liberated forces of nature for purposes of destruction may have to bear the responsibility of opening the door to an era of devastation on an unimaginable scale." Rose, geopolitically, how do you reckon with that statement 75 years after we did indeed drop those bombs?
I'd like to point to the continuing role of scientists in trying to put this genie back in the bottle. That is a very good example you raised of the memo that was sent to Truman. But shortly thereafter, in the 1950s, in fact, 1955, so it's also an anniversary for the so-called Russell-Einstein Manifesto. Bertrand Russell, the greatest philosopher of his day, joined with Albert Einstein, who had been part of the team creating the atomic bomb in the Manhattan Project, prominent physicist. But they joined together with a number of other scientists to make the first case for nuclear disarmament and to say that we have unleashed this terrible power. It is not a power that we should pursue further for military uses, and we need to look for ways to get rid of it. And through the years, scientists have continued to speak out in this way. It's very interesting that in the case of the Soviet Union, they also had their scientists who stepped forward. Sakharov was their physicist equivalent of Einstein, who had been involved in developing their bomb, and he stepped forward also. So actually, it's very interesting in a way that there's a kind of scientific alliance over the decades that has been focused on this effort to continue to reduce and eliminate. And while it's not going to be possible to get the genie totally back in the bottle, because people will continue to know about how to make nuclear weapons, even if somehow we are able to eliminate them from the face of the earth. But nevertheless, I do think that it's notable that scientists over time have taken this very serious, responsible role.
Alex, you're a nuclear weapons historian. You are in frequent communication with atomic scientists. What do you see as scientists' role in this?
The scientists who were part of the Manhattan Project, they saw themselves as having a sort of unique responsibility. Many of them did, not all of them. And that as the people who had brought this into the world, they had something to say about what ought to be done with it. And I think it's important to recognize that the kind of scientists we're talking about usually are physicists who, prior to World War II, this was seen as a form of science that didn't have much impact on anything, especially theoretical physics. And then suddenly they become the ones who have the power of life and death for entire civilizations. So many of them took this quite to heart. Some of them didn't. Some of them, like many people, scientists and engineers today, essentially said, look, my job is to do the equations. It's up to the politicians to make good use of them. I feel in my own classes, I teach engineering and STEM students almost primarily, and we frequently talk about these questions. And generally speaking, my sense is that the STEM students of today, and this is, I mean, my students, no disrespect, I love them a lot, but they see this as sort of not their problem, that the reason they've been pushed into STEM in the first place is usually not because they want to discover the secrets of the universe, but because we equate that with a good salary in the modern United States. And they are happy to work for, as Eisenhower would call it, the military-industrial complex. Those are the really good jobs. And I push them on this, of course, but it's a really, I feel like our cultural norms today about what is the responsibility of a scientist or an engineer towards the use of their product. We don't have the same conversations as much as were happening during the Cold War, where this was really taken up as a serious issue of discussion. And today, most of the students I talk to in particular, they sort of think this is a question for old hippies, not a sort of relevant question for people who are about to embark on a career.
Interesting. They're more craftsmen almost, or journeymen in their work. Rose, shifting gears a little bit, we had the peak of nuclear weaponry as far as numbers on Earth came during the Cold War. Now we have, by some estimates, around 14,000, much less than that time period. What worked in bringing that number down? What has worked in your years of negotiations in working towards disarmament?
You have to focus on equal benefit on any deal that you're putting together. It doesn't matter if it's a business deal or a nuclear arms treaty. Clearly, you have to seek that sweet spot where there's mutual benefit for each party. And so over time, that has clearly evolved. We started negotiating these kinds of arms limitation treaties back in the 1970s, and they have evolved over time. What has really worked, though, is ensuring good implementation. That is, ensuring that neither side could cheat. We worried a lot about the Soviets in the 1970s when we didn't really have on-site verification. And so throughout the 80s, pushed for on-site inspection. The Soviets didn't want to open up their facilities to us. But by the time we got to the Reagan administration and then the administration of George H.W. Bush, the Russians, the Soviets were beginning to open up a bit. It was the Gorbachev era. We were able to negotiate treaties like the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty and the first Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty that had thoroughgoing on-site inspection, and our inspectors could go to Russian nuclear facilities and see what kind of systems were there, actually count missiles on the ground. This was a big breakthrough that really ensured that not only could we get a good deal at the negotiating table, but then once we got it, that it would be properly implemented. Claire, I'd just like to mention, though, that the cheating problem isn't over with the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. It was a total ban on these weapons in the range of 500 to 5,500 kilometers. And once it was totally implemented as a ban, we destroyed all those weapons. The Russians began to cheat on that treaty because the inspection regime went away. They didn't any longer have eyes on them in the way they had before. And that is one reason why the current administration stepped out of the INF treaty at this time last year. They notified the Russians that because they were cheating, we could no longer stay in the treaty. So that was a serious decision. All the allies went along with it. I was at NATO. It was a tough decision. Mm-hmm. But I think in the end of the day, we do have to ensure and keep a sharp eye out for violations of these treaties, or they won't work for us and they won't work for anybody else.
Well, the U.S. has also pulled out from the Open Skies Treaty, as well as the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty you mentioned. How dedicated would you say Washington is to disarmament?
Well, the Open Skies Treaty is a different case. For one thing, it is for conventional arms control, for monitoring conventional forces on the ground. It allows the Russians to fly over the United States several times a year and take photos. It allows us to fly over the Russian Federation several times a year and the Russians to fly in Europe as well. So, but the point about that treaty is that it augments capabilities we already have. They already have overhead satellites and different kinds of radar systems, but it is focused in a different way. I also want to tell you quite honestly that I see problems with Russian implementation of the Open Skies Treaty, but I don't see major violations in the way the current administration seems to be pointing out. For that reason, I would not withdraw from the Open Skies Treaty. And to be precise, the administration has said they plan to withdraw unless the Russians come back into compliance. So as I understand it, there's some work going on to try to deal with these compliance questions that are out there. And I hope that the Open Skies Treaty will survive because it is valuable not only for us, but I think our allies in Europe really make a lot of use of it.
Mm. We've been talking about nuclear weapons and the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki today on All Sides with Ann Fisher, my guests Rose Gottemuller and Alex Wellerstein. And Alex, you wrote a book, it's coming out next year, called Restricted Data, The History of Nuclear Secrecy in the United States. Rose has been talking about this verification, and I'm wondering how feasible surveillance really is of these stockpiles.
It's a tricky problem. It's one that's made more tricky by the fact that we insist on secrecy of our aspects of our stockpiles and they insist on secrecy of aspects of theirs. And in some ways, if you didn't have the secrecy, it might be easier to have the surveillance, but you'd lose something with that potentially. It's always been the tricky problem for people who have tried to come up with real world ways of limiting any kind of weapon, but especially nuclear weapons. You can trace this back to even during the Manhattan Project in World War II, they were thinking about this exact question. And the answer that they came up with then was, well, we'll just have to get rid of all secrecy. And that seems rather radical today. And obviously that's not the path we went down, but that was sort of their approach to doing this. And they don't just mean all secrecy in science. They meant essentially all secrecy in states in various ways as well. And so this is a pretty radical idea, reimagining of what the world would be like. I mean, they really had ambitions of scientists being able to go to the Soviet Union and walk around and look at everything. That didn't work out. And so we have these other ways of trying to get that information. At some level, you definitely need to have these verification measures. We've seen time and time again that a treaty without verification doesn't work. It just leads to violations that are in secret and sometimes very disturbing ones. On the other hand, the sort of, you're probably never going to have as much verification as the most paranoid among you would want. And so it can become an incredibly difficult puzzle to get yourself out of if you've concluded that you think they're doing something outside of your periphery or something like that. And at some level, there must be some amount of trust involved. And I think these treaties, aside from their sort of technical ways of keeping states in line, they have value when they are expressions of a form of mutual trust.
Alex Wellerstein is a nuclear weapons historian at the Stevens Institute of Technology. He and Rose Gottemuller, Columbus native, from 2016 to 2019, served as the Deputy Secretary General of NATO and Chief Negotiator of the U.S.-Russian New START Nuclear Arms Reduction Treaty, are both staying with us for the third segment of All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Claire Roth. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Claire Roth sitting in for Anne today. We're talking about nuclear weapons on the 75th anniversary of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima, Japan. Still with us is Alex Wellerstein, a nuclear weapons historian at the Stevens Institute of Technology and the author of the forthcoming book, Restricted Data, The History of Nuclear Secrecy in the United States. Thanks again, Alex.
Happy to be here.
And Rose Gottemuller, a Columbus native who from 2016 to 2019 served as Deputy Secretary General of NATO. She was also, prior to that, the U.S. Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security. Welcome again, Rose.
Thank you so much.
So you are the chief negotiator of the U.S.-Russian New START Nuclear Arms Reduction Treaty. It's expected to expire in February. It can be extended for up to 5 years. What kind of movement do you expect to see in terms of extending it or replacing it?
There's a debate going on in Washington right now over this. When President Trump first came into office, he heard about the treaty for the first time in a phone call with President Putin. Putin at the time said to him, why don't we go ahead and extend the New START treaty? This was back when he first came into office in 2016. The answer from the president when he heard about it was, well, that's a treaty that my predecessor negotiated. I don't like it.
So it's probably hard to hear that about your work.
It was a bit hard, I have to say. But I must say that over time, I think there is a recognition that's grown that extending the New START treaty will give this administration the time to put in place an arms control treaty that is the president's, that has the president's name on it. And that's something that they are working on right now. So I think that if they need New START extended to complete the negotiation of a new treaty, they will be ready to do so. But it's still a debate. It's still a question. And we'll see what happens. I know when you look at the Democratic platform that already it's clear that if, President Biden comes into office, if he is elected, then he's ready to extend the New START treaty. So I think that will be rather straightforward. He won't have much time because the treaty goes out of force on February 5th. He would be
just about 2 weeks.
it's 15 days to be exact. So the bottom line is that a new Biden administration would have to act fast on this. But it's quite straightforward. We negotiated it to be possible with a simple exchange of diplomatic notes. So it's not like it has to come back to the Senate or any big new negotiation has to take place.
You're a decade on from when you negotiated that agreement or when it was signed, rather. What sort of dialogue are we seeing now around nuclear disarmament? How has the landscape changed in that 10 years?
The Russians have completed pretty much a modernization of their nuclear triad. The nuclear triad, there are the bombers, the intercontinental ballistic missiles that are deployed on land, and the submarine-based ballistic missiles. So those are, that's why it's called a triad, the three legs, air, land, and sea. So they've completed a modernization of their triad at this point, and the United States is now embarking on a modernization of our triad. The important thing about New START is it keeps those modernization programs under a certain limit. They and we are allowed to deploy no more than 700 delivery vehicles, missiles, that would be capable of destroying not only each other but the world if there was ever a major exchange of those missiles. 700 is still a lot, but is way down from where we were during the Cold War years when each of us had thousands of such missiles deployed against each other. So the point is we need to embark on a nuclear modernization now, but we need to keep it under limits. We don't want to get into an arms race.
We pay a lot of attention to the U.S. and to Russia for good reason. We have about 4,800 weapons, according to the Union of Concerned Scientists. Russia has 4,300. But of course, there are other countries that are either working on their nuclear programs or attempting to. When you look more broadly, are there any rising concerns, China, Iran, otherwise, that you're paying attention to?
Well, it's very clear that China is also modernizing and is beginning to acquire a more full triad, a more complete triad of air, sea, and land-based missiles and weapon systems. And so for that reason, I think we need to keep a sharp eye on China. And that's something the administration, the Trump administration, has called for. I agree with them that we need to keep a sharp eye. We need to start to talk to the Chinese about coming to the negotiating table. They've never participated before, so it's important to engage them. But I think we also have to remember that their numbers are way smaller than ours. You mentioned that we and the Russians both have over 4,000 warheads. The Chinese, by most accounts, have between 300 and 500. So they have about 400 warheads. So it's a big difference. And so I don't think we need to panic about the Chinese at this moment, but we need to keep a sharp eye on them. And we need to talk them into coming to the table and beginning to talk.
Rose, we know you have to go in just a moment. Before we let you go, you contributed to a new book that's called A World Free from Nuclear Weapons. How far away is that reality?
Well, President Obama, who was quite focused on this, gave a speech, a famous speech in Prague right as he was elected president. And he said that we need to pursue this world without nuclear weapons, but it's not going to happen in my lifetime. And I feel the same. This is not going to happen in my lifetime, but it's a goal that we have to keep in front of us. We have to keep focusing on, and we have to push hard to accomplish. I really want to commend the team that put that book together. It grew out of a conference that we had at the Vatican back in November of 2017. Pope Francis himself was very much involved in this issue. And so I think we see, you know, support for this coming from all directions, from the Catholic Church, from a number of religious bodies, even the Russian Orthodox Church. And I think the problem Alex pointed to earlier of getting people interested again, whether it's students, whether it's grown-ups, whether it's people, you know, across the country who never really have to think about nuclear problems. But I think it is a matter of our supreme responsibility as a nation, and that we really do need somehow to get people focused on this issue again. So I was glad to participate in the project, and I really think that it's a great thing that the church is involved and willing and ready to push this issue forward.
Rose Gottemuller, thank you so much for joining the program today.
It was my pleasure, truly. Thank you so much, Claire.
Rose is a Columbus native. She was the first woman to serve as Deputy Secretary General of NATO from 2016 to 2019. She was also before that the U.S. Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security and the chief negotiator for the U.S.-Russian New START Nuclear Arms Reduction Treaty. We are talking about nuclear weapons today on the 75th anniversary of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima, Japan, here on 89.7 NPR's News, All Sides with Ann Fisher. That's my other program. And still with us is Alex Wellerstein. It's a nuclear weapons historian at the Stevens Institute of Technology, author of the book Restricted Data, The History of Nuclear Secrecy in the United States. And Alex, this week, the mushroom cloud explosion in Beirut caused some to speculate it was a nuclear weapon. And you and other nuclear scholars dismissed that very quickly on Twitter. I'm curious if that illustrates how much we understand nuclear weapons in the public consciousness.
Most people don't have a great understanding of the magnitude of a nuclear explosion. And so if they see a large explosion or see a mushroom cloud, like in the case of Beirut, their mind immediately goes to nuclear. If you study this stuff a bit, you know that mushroom clouds result from all explosions. Even very small ones will have a very tiny mushrooming effect. It's just it's what happens when a fireball is moving through the atmosphere. It's a sort of fundamental physical interaction. And you also know that nuclear weapons have a pretty distinctive, their explosions have distinctive characteristics. Aside from the fact that you can tell with the Geiger counter and other sorts of scientific tools, even their appearances look quite different. The colors, the brightness, these things are pretty evident. But so it's very easy to sort of look at one of these and say, clearly not a nuclear explosion if you've studied these things. I do think it's interesting that that's the only reference people have for an explosion. And I think this is a good thing in a way, because it means we don't see a lot of actual explosions in real life. Are nuclear weapons, though, on the other hand, even small nuclear weapons tend to be much larger than the Beirut explosion. The highest estimates of the power of the Beirut explosion that I've seen are between about 2,000 and 3,000 tons of TNT equivalent. So that's five times less than the Hiroshima bomb in terms of explosive power.
And you created a tool to help people understand the scope, the magnitude of nuclear weapons. It's called Nuke Map. I actually have it pulled up here. And you can essentially put in your city and then put in a bomb, like, for instance, Little Boy, which is the one that was detonated over Hiroshima, to see how far the heavy blast damage would be, how far the radiation would be, and on and on. Why did you decide to make that tool? What was your reasoning behind it?
It's very hard, even for people who study these things, to intuitively make sense of what these weapons can do. If I say to people 15 kilotons, if I say 15 megatons, for most people that doesn't mean that much. And even for many nuclear wonks, we could say that's not something you necessarily carry around in your head. And so allowing you to put these kinds of effects onto places that people know is a way to sort of make these weapons a little bit more understandable and maybe a little bit more personal. And in my experience, people have kind of complex reactions when they use this tool. Some of them say these weapons are much smaller than I expected, because Hollywood has sort of conditioned us to think that if one bomb goes off, the whole world is destroyed. And it's not quite like that. But then you also have people, especially when they drill down into the results, they think, oh my God, this is really awful. This is way worse than the kinds of conventional accidents or even terrorist attacks that we've experienced in our lifetimes. The death tolls are much larger. The areas destroyed are much larger.
And I have to say that when I look at this map, it does put it in context for me. If that sort of bomb, the one that was over Hiroshima, was detonated over the State House, for instance, the radiation damage would go out to the Arena District. And that helps me understand, oh, this is what the fatality might look like. It gives me a context I just couldn't really access otherwise, because it's hard to picture in your head.
Some of these things are just hard to know anyway. I mean, the calculating the estimated fatalities, you have to know population density of every place that you're using it and exactly where the bomb is going off. And even I study these things and I don't know those things off the top of my head. I built this tool in part for myself because I would like to know these things, but then it also became clear that other people would like to know these things as well.
I'm wondering if this is generational at all in terms of how much we think about nuclear bombs. I'm a millennial, and growing up, I hardly ever thought about nuclear war. I didn't think of it as a real possibility. It kind of seemed 1950s quaint, like duck and cover, that sort of thing. Is this something that we need to have more cognizance of? Is this something we need to be, dare I say, more afraid of?
It's definitely generational. My colleagues at Stevens and I have done a lot of research into nuclear attitudes, and there's sort of a clear indication that if you grew up during the Cold War, you take them much more seriously. You are much more aware of what they can do. People in the post-Cold War, the sort of world sort of exhaled deeply and said, "Phew, we're done with that. We're through that. The danger's gone." It's very clear that the danger didn't actually go away. Some dangers were lessened, and we certainly have fewer weapons around than we did in the Cold War, but it doesn't take that many weapons to destroy things. I think that, you know, we have a lot of stuff to worry about in the world today. And when I talk to young people, we find that they care about a lot of things that are very important. It's not like they're sitting around blissfully happy and unaware that the world has problems. They are passionately concerned with climate change and social justice and economic inequality and a lot of really important issues. But nuclear isn't on that list. They won't, generally speaking, your average millennial, but much less like a
Gen Z,
they won't sort of offer up nuclear weapons as a concern unprompted. And I think that, I'm not saying that nuclear weapons need to be at the top of their list. We have a lot of things on that list at the moment, but I think they should probably be on the list.
In January, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists set the doomsday clock to 100 seconds to midnight. And it feels like we've been so close to midnight for so long, it's easy to ignore. Like, there's almost like a vigilance fatigue. Do you find that that's true?
it's very hard to conjure up for people the depth of the possible catastrophe when you've been living under a shadow of all sorts of catastrophes for a while. And I'm sympathetic to the people at the Bulletin who make the decision on the setting of the clock, because every time they go back to look at the clock, they tend to agree that things are getting worse, not better. But if they keep endlessly marching towards midnight, it diminishes the power of marching towards midnight. And I can see that that's a hard bind, and also why they've now started dividing it up into seconds.
Well, thank you so much, Alex Wellerstein, for joining us today. Nuclear weapons historian at the Stevens Institute of Technology, author of Restricted Data, History of Nuclear Secrecy. You've been listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.